Good evening. I'm Roxana Markoch, curator in the Department of Photography, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to this evening panel discussion, organized in conjunction with the exhibition The Original Copy, Photography of Sculpture, 1839 to Today, on view at the Museum of Modern Art. This panel features a distinguished group of colleagues, George Baker, Associate Professor of Modern and Contemporary Art and Vice Chair UCLA Department of Art History, Mark Godfrey, Curator Tate Modern, Sarah Hamill, Assistant Professor of Modern and Contemporary Art, Oberlin College, and artist Rachel Harrison, whose work is featured in the exhibition. I'm going to start with a synopsis of the original copy. Each panelist will then map a particular set of ideas in direct or indirect link to the exhibition as a means of expanding its premises. And then this will be followed by a discussion with the audience. I would like to thank Pablo Helguera, Director, Adult and Academic Programs, and Laura Bales Coppola, Assistant Director, Adult Programs at MoMA, for organizing this event, and I would like to ask you to turn off your cell phones. Conceived around 10 conceptual modules, the original copy probes the critical roles photography has taken part in redefining what sculpture is by bringing into play original and reproduction, image and layout, 19th and 21st century modalities. One, Sculpture in the Age of Photography considers how shortly after its advent in 1839, photography became the primary medium of analysis in the modern discipline of art history. Writing a century after its invention, the novelist and politician André Malraux praised photography's capacity to archive, display, and circulate images of art. In his 1947 book, Le Musée Imaginaire, which famously advocated a pan-cultural museum without walls, Malraux postulated that art history, and the history of sculpture in particular, had become the history of that which can be photographed. If we consider photography an offspring of the Industrial Revolution, a medium that came of age alongside the steam engine and the railroad, it is not surprising that one of its early functions was to deracinate the physically inaccessible art object from its original site and bring it closer to the viewer by means of reproduction. Charles Nègre, for example, photographed sculpture in the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris, circling it at different heights to penetrate rarely seen details, or stage a portrait of his friend Henri Le Sec against the Gothic-style gargoyle appended to the building during Viollet-le-Duc's restoration. While in London, Roger Fenton and Stephen Thompson documented the ancient statuary in the British Museum, making visible the new power of collecting institutions. The flowering of photographic surveys of historic sites, public sculpture, and ruins, which began to be conducted increasingly far afield, coincided with European dominion and Western imperialist exploits, the so-called mission civilisatrice, or civilizing missions. Traveling to the Near East in 1849-51, together with the novelist Gustave Flaubert, Maxime Ducamp took pictures of sites as uninhibited spaces free for Europeans to claim. Measuring by using the body of a Nubian sailor, as you can see here, to provide the sense of scale, surveying and photographing monuments were activities illustrating the need for intervention on foreign land. This introductory module presents pictures of sculpture in situ, in the artist's studio, and in the context of museums, underlying photography's implication in the analysis of virtually every aspect, formal, social, political, of art. Two. Eugène Agé. During the first quarter of the 20th century, Agé took hundreds of photographs of sculptures, classical statues, reliefs, friezes, fountains, urns, and other decorative fragments in Paris and its outlying parks, his work amounting to a visual compendium of the heritage of French civilization at the time. An habitué of the theatrical stage, Agé photographed the gardens that André Le Nôtre, the landscape architect of King Louis XIV, had designed in the second half of the 17th century at Versailles, focusing on their scenic organization and the sculpture's performativity, as if characters in a historical play. Agé was the Cézanne of photography. With an eye trained for unsettling images, he took pictures of the same motif numerous times, yet never twice the same. His pictures reflect the variable play between nature and culture through minute shifts in the camera's angle or as functions of passing time as underscored in his notations of the exact month and sometimes even the hour when the pictures were taken. 3. Auguste Rodin. Rodin never took pictures of his sculptures, but he reserved the creative act for himself, actively directing the enterprise of photographing his work. He controlled staging, lighting, background, point of view, and was probably the first sculptor to realize that through photography, one could make multiple reproductions at low cost, as evident in his decision of exhibiting pictures along with his sculptures, using the Nubendium to show more sculpture than the actual space would allow. Throughout the 1890s, he treated his most frequently used photographers, such as Eugène Drouet, as his practiciens, the highly skilled professional sculptors who assisted in the studio. After 1900, however, Rodin teamed up with younger photographers, including Edward Steichen, whose soft-focused pictures imbued with misty sfumato appealed to his own pictorialist sensibility. Steichen experimented with ex post facto techniques of darkroom manipulations in Rodin the Thinker to create not a portrait, but a legend by combining two negatives, Rodin in silhouetted profile facing the thinker, his alter ego, against the monument to Victor Hugo, a source of poetic inspiration. He also produced a temporal series of the same sculpture when he photographed Rodin's Balzac installed outdoors in the sculptor's garden at Meudon, spending a night taking varying exposures from 15 minutes to an hour to secure a number of dramatic negatives. 4. Constantin Brancusi. Brancusi included many photographers among his friends, yet he declined to have his work photographed by others, preferring instead to take, develop, and print his own pictures. He used photography as an analytical apparatus and as metaphor. Consider his picture Newborn II, circa 1925, which juxtaposes a close-up view of the polished bronze ovoid with a magnifying glass, an instrument of precision optics. With its handle pointing towards the viewer's side, the glass invites one to look closer at the blurred, anamorphic view of the studio, a world in perpetual flux. The image thematizes the tensions in Brancusi's production, purity of sculptural form and pregnant impurity, integrity of structure and incoherence of surface, clarity of the visual field and spatial distortion. Pushing photography against its grain, Brancusi developed an aesthetic antithetical to photographic standards. His so-called photoradieuses are characterized by flashes of light that explode the unity of the sculptural gestalt. In search of transparency, kineticism, and infinity, Brancusi used photography and polishing techniques to dematerialize the static monolithic materiality of traditional sculpture, visualizing what Laszlo Moholy-Nagy called the new culture of light. Furthermore, Brancusi articulated the studio around transitory configurations known as groupe mobile, each comprising sculptures, bases, and pedestals grouped in proximity. Assembling and reassembling his sculptures for the camera, Brancusi used photography as an ars combinatoria, making clear that one and the same sculpture can be invested with different meanings simultaneously. Only photography, it has been suggested, shows that Brancusi belongs to the great combinatorialist of modernism, Erik Satie, Arnold Schoenberg, Stefan Mallarmé, and James Joyce. 5. Marcel Duchamp. In 1913, Duchamp jotted down the following note: "Can one make works which are not works of art? A thought focused less on beauty than on what is possible." Soon afterwards, he conceived his first ready-mades, immediately altering the definition of what constitutes an art object. Duchamp translated into the third dimension a principle that photographers had long used to challenge painting, selection rather than creation. In 1935, Duchamp began his Box in a Valise, a catalogue of his works to date. Featuring 69 reproductions, including minute replicas of several ready-mades and one original work, the box combines the format of a retrospective exhibition with that of a loose-leaf album of photographs. Rather than use the quick photographic techniques then available, however, Duchamp opted to create his reproductions by combining colotype printing with the elaborate method of pochoir, in which color is applied by hand with the use of stencils. He recreated or duplicated his oeuvre, then copyrighted it in the name of Rose de la Vie, producing authorized original copies. Photography played a critical role in Duchamp's deployment of ready-mades and installations. It was a medium not reducible to its physical properties, but rather open to the interplay of possibilities that he reckoned with in its own right, as proved by his pointed response to a question from Alfred Stieglitz in 1922. Can a photograph have the significance of art? Stieglitz asked. Dear Stieglitz, Duchamp answered, even a few words I don't feel like writing. You know exactly what I think of photography. I would like to see it make people despise painting until something else will make photography unbearable. There we are. Affectionately, Marcel Duchamp. 6. Cultural and political icons. What role do photographs play in mediating history and memory? To begin just with the consequences of two world wars, the rise and fall of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of communism in former Eastern Europe, the after effects of apartheid in South Africa, the question of memorialization has been salient in thinking on photography. Walker Evans' image of a crushed Ionic column made of cheap sheet metal, Robert Frank's picture of a statue of St. Francis preaching, cross and Bible in hands to the bleak vista of a gas station, Lee Friedlander's photograph of World War I hero Father Duffy, engulfed in the mix of Times Square's billboards and neon, threatening to jeopardize the sculpture's patriotic message, and David Goldblatt's pictures of monuments to some of the most potent symbols of Afrikaner triumphalism, all take a critical look at the world that public statues inhabit. Debates over how to probe the past from critical perspectives have produced alternative modes of memory telling. The stage self-portraits that Anselm Kiefer shot while traveling through Europe in 1969, which were published under the title Occupations in the art journal Interfunktionen in 1975, show the artist in front of different statues giving the Heil Hitler salute. Performed exclusively for the camera, the picture suggests that public monuments generate human reactions and that memory involves acts of the resistance against forgetting when confronting an irrecoverable past. 7. The Studio Without Walls. With geographical analogies, Cyprien Gaillard, the youngest artist in the exhibition, interfaces the traditions of sculpture in the public field and sculpture in the expanded field. Shot in different locations from 2006 to 2009, Geographical Analogies is a collection of over 900 Polaroids, an extremely fugitive medium, arranged in cases, each telling stories of civic monuments, architectonic utopias, and ruins in reverse, that is, of structures rising into ruin before they are built. In the late 1960s, a radical aesthetic change altered both the definition of the sculptural object and the ways in which that object was experienced. Artists who did not consider themselves photographers in the traditional sense began using the camera to rework the idea of what sculpture is, dispensing with the immobile object in favor of an altered site, physical and social. In 1969, Robert Smithson traveled across the Yucatan Peninsula to strategically orchestrate the scattering of 12 square mirrors across 9 sites, photographing the mirror's displacement of the landscape through the camera's multiple points of view. Smithson's friend, Gordon Matta-Clark, used the camera to undo architecture, or perhaps just the American dream of progress, literally dissecting buildings, cutting them into gravity-defying walk-through sculptures. In their social analysis of a destabilized urban environment, these artists' pictures and celluloid collages dovetail with the entropic preoccupations of Gaillard's work. 8. Daguerre's Soup. In 1932, Brassai photographed in close-up series in close-up a series of found objects, tiny cast of scraps of paper, strangely shaped bits of bread, smudged pieces of soap, and accidental blobs of toothpaste, which he and Salvador Dali titled involuntary sculptures. Shot close-up, magnified, and presented out of context, the objects communicate automatic human gestures. Brassai's pictures preface a whole strand of post-war production based on compulsive processes and the diversification of object types. In 1971, Alina Zhaposnikov produced photo sculptures by masticating chewing gum. Skewed towards surrealism through the filter of mid-century nouveau realism, this photographic series announces the transgressions of a generation of artists emerging a decade later, such as Fishley and Weiss, whose tongue-in-cheek constructions shot on the verge of collapse manipulate photography's documentary status as a source of playfulness. Their unruliness nods to a line of thought present in Marcel Breuer's insincere taxonomies. Here, Breuer's picture, Daguerre's Soup, hints at the various fluids and chemicals processes used by Louis Daguerre to invent photography in the 19th century, but also brings into play experimental ideas about language and the realm of everyday objects. Tapping on Breuer's illogical and parodic collections of objects, Rachel Harrison's pictures from Voyage of the Beagle, visible in the row above, raise a befuddling question: what is sculpture? Through objects which in their range of types and sequencing, from prehistoric standing stones to mass-produced pop mannequins to modernist sculptures to topiaries, suspend sculpture's ontological fixity. 9. The Pygmalion Complex. The subject of the animated statue spans the history of avant-garde photography. Artists interested in surrealist tactics use the camera to tap the uncanniness of hybrid puppets and flesh-and-blood models, wax dummies on Hollywood movie studios, mannequins and automata of all kinds producing pictures that both transcribe and alter appearances. The perturbing tension between animate object and inanimate form, specifically female form, lies at the crux of many of Man Ray's photographs, such as Noire Blanche, which couples the head of Kiki of Montparnasse with an African ceremonial mask, inviting such cultural pairings as Europe, Africa, modernism, ritual, flesh ebony. Hans Bellmer's photographs of dismembered dolls and the critical photomontages of Herbert Bayer, Hannah Hoch, and Johannes Theodor Bargalt, who simultaneously presents himself as classical sculptor, woman, and amputee, formulate anatomical dictionaries of ambivalently animate forms in response to the disturbing politics of the interwar period of the late 1920s and early 30s. The performing body, a sculpture object, then. In the first issue of the American avant-garde magazine Avalanche, in 1970, the critic Willoughby Sharp defined the use of the artist's own body as sculptural material. Placing a premium on their training as sculptors, artists such as Valley expert Dennis Oppenheim and Charles Ray articulated the body as a prop that could be picked up, bent, or deployed instead of more traditional materials. Others, such as Gilbert and George, Hannah Wilke, Otto Mühl, Anna Mendieta, Bastian Ader, and Bruce Nauman proposed distinct modes of meaning for sculpture that corresponded closely to that of the photograph, modes in which the physical self expressly performed for the camera. Several of Nauman's pictures, including Feet of Clay, Bound to Fail, and Waxing Hot, spoof the classical tradition of sculpture. The signature image of the group, Self-Portrait, is a fountain in which a strip to the waist Nauman spews water from his mouth, is a deadpan salute to Duchamp's fountain. In fact, Nauman made this series of photographs after seeing Duchamp's retrospective at the Pasadena Art Museum in 1963. Collectively, the images would come to be known simply as 11 color photographs, a statement of what one can do with and through the agency of photography. Thank you. And right now I would like to invite George Baker.
Yeah. Thank you, Roxana, for the invitation. I thought I would speak informally at first, and then I have a very short thing to read, like three paragraphs from a much longer piece that I've been working on this summer that I feel could be in dialogue with the exhibition, although the artist is not in the exhibition. And I'm going to end by reciting a poem, reading a poem by this artist, not by me, to you. I just saw the exhibition for the first time today, and I have to admit to being a bit overwhelmed, and I think Roxana's presentation also points in this direction by the many, many different directions the show takes and the many, many different directions then one's comments and relationship to it could take. Well, I'm going through a Smith stage, so this was my first reaction to thinking about sculpture and photography. It's a Smith's reference if you don't get it. But to try to orient myself a little bit, what I usually tend to and wind up doing is try to bring some history to bear on my confusions. So I have a couple of memories that I just want to insert here at the beginning of my remarks, and I will time myself more or less. And I don't mean any of these memories in any way judgmentally. I'm not sure whether the historical memory or the current conjecture we find ourselves in is better or worse. It's not about judgment that I'm trying to get at in my next few comments, but more about orienting oneself. So the first thing that I wanted to think about was the title of the exhibition, the original copy. I'm believing it's coming from Duchamp. Now, in a past not too distant, in a galaxy not so far away, in the 70s and 80s, there were many critics around the theorization of postmodernism who were working with photography and its relationship to other arts in an exactly diametrically opposed relationship to the title of the current exhibition, as opposed to the original copy. Photography was, the attempt at that point was to think photography as a kind of copy without an original. And the hopes behind this term, the hopes behind this theoretical model, in this moment, as I understand it looking back, the hopes was that photography in some kind of still residually avant-garde and utopian manner could rupture many of the unities of either the museum or of modernism itself, of medium-specific practices like painting and sculpture. Photography was some kind of alien agent, in other words, in the museum, some kind of alien agent to painting and sculpture, to mediums that had developed over history and through long traditions. Photography would rupture all that. You know, in the most hyperbolic and intense versions of this vision, such as Douglas Crimp's On the Museum's Ruins, the photograph would enter into the museum like a kind of terrorist bomb and seemingly destroy all memory and tradition. That obviously didn't happen. But I'm interested in this reversal, perhaps if we can call it that, that we might be facing today. And another shift that struck me, not just between this idea that photography wouldn't be simply in dialogue with another form like sculpture, but in the past the photography would present a major problem to the ongoing practice of those mediums like sculpture. Stated like this, I mean, the conjuncture of the 70s and 80s, the theorization of postmodernism I'm trying to summarize very briefly, obviously was a kind of continual working out of some of the legacies of the avant-garde, specifically things that had happened within artistic practice and the use of photography by the moment of the 60s and early 70s. So the theorists were a little bit, and the critics a little bit later, trying to work through some of the ideas of practice, I think, that in this show are embodied most by the works of art in the exhibition from the 60s and early 70s. Another idea to put as a memory against the kind of things that I saw in the exhibition today, this notion of photography breaking open the unities of artist or oeuvre or style, the workings of the museum around medium categories like painting and sculpture, that postmodern idea, whatever has happened to it or become of it, it was based on an ideology of rupture. And so I was wondering as I walked into the first gallery and was confronted by, I think, the immensely confusing sight of certain contemporary works or almost contemporary works like Barbara Kruger, Louise Lawler, or Cindy Sherman. I guess I should move my slide forward. In the same room with 19th century photographs, as opposed to that old story of rupture and the postmodern ideology that photography was an agent of rupture and truly an agent of a massive shift and change in cultural practice, in the state of the culture. Is this a history of continuity that we face here today? Now, another question. What does that history of continuity mean, from looking at the origins of photography to some kind of set of logics? They seem to be rather disparate ones that are being worked out in contemporary practice today. Are my oppositions straw men? Are they too pat? Rupture versus continuity, copies without originals or origins, the original copy. What I'm actually interested in doing is turning to a very different memory in the couple of minutes that remain to me in this presentation today, to think about ways in which this relationship that the exhibition seems devoted to, sculpture and photography, might be thought that are neither about either rupture on the one hand and the avant-gardist claims that might still attach to that, or continuity on the other and the kind of anti-modernist claims that might attach to that in the old ways we thought these things. I want to turn to a memory of a form of artistic practice within modernism, continuing into the present moment, namely collage, that seemingly holds not to neither of these models I may have just laid out. Collage was always there in modernism. It was never medium specific. It was always a problem for modernism, but for many it embodied the modern itself as a kind of system of fragmentation and discontinuity. What I want to turn to is a memory then of a form in which sculpture and photography actually did meet and come together in a certain moment and perhaps continue to do so today. But I also want to think about the manner of their relation. And I just want to put forward a kind of case study. And this is the artist Richard Hawkins that I'm turning to now. A case study in which photography and sculpture do take up a certain set of well-defined relationships, and I want to explore a little bit with you in the few minutes remaining what those relationships could be said to be. They're not anything like what a friend of mine, an artist in Los Angeles, the artist Waleed Beshti has been joking with me about when I told him I was coming to speak on this panel about sculpture and photography, and he would say to me always, he keeps telling the same joke, you're going to talk about sculptography then. Or sometimes he would think maybe there's another way of saying this. Maybe we could call it photographature, which was a little bit more inelegant, I think. Sculptography is not what the current set of artistic practices I've been most interested in that think about a meeting place, neither one of rupture nor of continuity between two forms might be or might look like. What could it look like? So turning to the example of Richard Hawkins' work, I'm showing you, I just have a few collages to show you, and the way in which Hawkins practices collage, obviously, photographic reproductions have a central place. But his use of those reproductions always seemed to be quite specific. The way in which the photograph is used in his manner of producing collage is always quite specific. And it's always seemingly, whatever else we could say about Slash and Francis Bacon, whatever we could say about the contents of the collages I might be showing you tonight, the form seems always very simple and self-evident. The photograph is laid on top of some kind of ground. And I have just one other example, Johnny Depp, Gustave Moreau. Overlay and occlusion is the modality of collage and the way in which photography lives in collage. The photograph's place, in other words, in collage, is one that produces lack, absence, or a kind of void. Now, but this void, however, and this is true for collage, I think, more or less altogether, not just for this artist, for Richard Hawkins, this void is spatial. It is a form of building, or because it produces a kind of occlusion or lack, unbuilding, we might also say, or as the case may be. When the photographic image becomes spatial, we could also say, and this is what I've been trying to think through in the longer project I've been working on in the last few months, it gains a backside, an underneath. It begins to tarry with the void, with the unknown. It begins to have or to call up what I've been trying to explore and to call the underground. In other words, the underground, or that which a photograph cannot present, just the backside of the image, that which you will not see, that which cannot be given to vision, emerges, in fact, when photography becomes spatial, or we might rephrase that and say when photography is considered, as it is in collage, sculpturally, as a spatial practice, and not just as an image, but as matter and as material. And of course, this occurs contrariwise with sculpture, and Hawkins' turn to sculpture, like any collage artist, seems a logical step. One moves from the flat dimensions of the image into actual, real, three-dimensional or material space. But the artist in this case always seems to be playing with the fact that, like photographs, sculptures as objects, they too have backsides. They cannot be fully present to vision at once. Like good imaginary, I'll put that in quotes, modernist objects were always thought to be, I think. For there never was such a thing, according to this model I'm exploring, as a modernist object. It was always a pure, very pleasurable, but essentialist fantasy, and one often dreamed in an older version of this very building where we're standing, sitting. To the photographs underneath, the sculpture adds a backside. Two forms, and I have some other images, some other sculptures by Richard Hawkins to show you, but I'm pressing the wrong button, of course. To the photographs underneath, the sculpture now adds a backside, two forms of unknowing, two spaces where a medium points to what lies quite literally beyond it. And this beyond, the thing that neither photography nor sculpture quite has, this actually is the only thing the two mediums, as I've been considering them, can be said to share. What do mediums share? They share what they do not have. What was that? What would that mean? One other image. This is the backside of the sculpture I was just showing you from 2010 a moment ago. On the right, representational on the front, and seemingly abstract on the back. Now, Hawkins has explored this kind of relationship between photography and sculpture in various ways. The otherness opened up by both sculpture and photography, taken as a kind of desiring condition. This has been the very point of a quite massive and as yet unfinished collage series that the artist has been producing from 2006 until the present. It's still unfinished, the last fifth section. There's five sections to this work called Urbis Paganus, has not been completed. But here is a series of photo collages now that are in fact in the artist's work literally about sculpture, using photographic reproductions from art monographs, history of art books, photographs of sculpture. A series of collages then that are about sculpture, about its form and its history both. And at least one grand formal element of Hawkins' project carries the reading I've been just briefly exploring out, returning to the kind of occluding structure of collage, to the formal operations of behind and beneath, and to what I want to call the legacies of the underground. At the climax of the collage's fourth cycle, the last one to be completed so far, the narrator, since the collages also use language and develop a kind of voice, the narrator opens up an elaborate art historical aside, an aesthetic treatise in the form of a kind of massive pun. The projects play with artistic posterity, sculptural posterity, transformed into a self-proclaimed treatise on posteriority. So here's the first image from this last cycle. Faced with the two-sidedness of sculpture, Hawkins' collages begin to collect images toward an analysis, and here I'm quoting the narrator, of the social function of the backsides of classical figurative sculpture. With sculpture always oriented, again quoting the narrator, toward the front, toward name, toward face, the narrator asks, why does sculpture even have a backside? Why not just leave it blank? The puns pile up as we're urged to, quote, look back to the long evolution of statuary, to a backstory, again quoting, where we would have the Greeks to thank for posteriority, for they stepped away from the Egyptian wall, the narrator notes, and concentrated much less on the pharaonic hereafter and much more, pun again, on simply what's left behind. From here, the treatise opens up an alternate dimension of the Urbis Paganus title, the latter word of which, as the critic Bruce Hainley has pointed out, contains the word anus, of course, a further pun, as if the work wanted to harvest the pagan mode of what the artist sees as affirmation for the anus, a work of art that would affirm the bottom, the backside, asses, in other words, and all the love and modes of appreciation that can be showered on them. In the treatise on posteriority, Hawkins' characteristic formal condition, a play with the behind or the underground of an artistic object or image, comes together with an explicit desiring one, their fusion inescapable, almost programmatic, one could say, for this precise conflation had never, of course, been absent from Hawkins' collages. Now the art historical lecture becomes a search for what Hawkins or the narrator calls lasciviousness and vividness, the proper use of sculpture's ass being the inappropriate paradigmatic substitution of the sexual object for the aesthetic one, as the narrator begins to imagine the repeated rubbing and caressing in various of the panels of marble posteriors. The collages parade so many beautiful bodies before us. The very pinnacle of Western ideas of contrapposto pose, the sculpture of Doryphorus, for example, is given to us from behind, ass first. We stare at the plump glutes of the Critios boy, blocking a view of the approach toward the hollowed Acropolis. We're greeted in every arena, we're told, by repeated images of Discobulus like a disco go-go boy, doubled over and offering up his flexed buttocks. And we're told to attend to the sensual and beautiful choro sculpture entitled the Chrysos from Anavisos, its sensuality giving way to, quote, vulgarity from behind, its heroic maleness reversed into plump and curving effeminacy. The poor boy, the narrator says, cursed from the back with the arched and swollen haunches of a whore. During the treatise on posteriority, Hawkins' columns of text usually start on the right-hand side of the collage and then move backward in broken columns, right to left. Reversal joins hand with the behind, with the underneath, with the backside. And the cycle culminates in a simple eulogy to the act of anasirma, the act of unveiling. So many stories of sculptures flashing their asses or their genitals at the viewer. A gesture as simple, the narrator notes, as the raising of a curtain, the hiking up of a skirt, producing a vision of what lies beneath, again I'm quoting the narrator, revelations, spectacles, charms, and wonders. To the extent that such is always the goal of art, Hawkins arrives in this collage cycle, Urbis Paganus, as what we might call a kind of reformation, both of desire, but also of aesthetics as well. For revelation wonder will now arrive for the artist from the underground, through all the modes of aesthetic backwardness and what the artist calls posteriority, the upside down and the underneath. The bigger vision, or the larger vision of Urbis Paganus, amounts to a map through which normative subjectivity and desire might get lost, wandering down other paths. It simultaneously builds an aesthetic treatise in praise of the powers of the underground, the transformation that emerges from the beneath and the behind, the unknowable void that spreads out from the bottom and from the below, the undeniable otherness that collage has always sought in what we could call the beyond. And it's here, in the beyond, at the point or the limit of the limit, or the otherness of photography to sculpture. It's here, what we might call the backside of the image, that photography and sculpture could be imagined to meet. Now, I just have one last thing. I'm out of time, but I want to read you this poem, if I'll be allowed, like, 2 more minutes. This is an earlier section of Urbis Paganus that I'm reading from. I believe it's not been exhibited. The climax of the third of the 5 planned sections of this collage cycle, in which one of the, I think, talismanic images of the MoMA exhibition arise before us as the artist and narrator devote the closing of the third section of this collage cycle to Henry Fox Talbot's images of the bust of Patroclus. It's a different relationship that emerges here of photography to sculpture than the kind of desiring one of lasciviousness and vividness that I just tried to lay out far too briefly. This one's more about, again, what neither medium could be said to have, but now in the mode not of desiring, but more of mourning and melancholia. I'll just read the poem and stop. Plaster cast Patroclus, dematerialized and ephemeral, once here, then gone, stone, fleeting as dissipated chasms of time and the flickering here again, lost once more, of vanished loves. I'd reduced time that summer day. After compressing half a morning into an hour, I labored in turning any number of minutes to much less than that, whittling them down to a few mere seconds before even those became, as they say, blinks of an eye. I soon then nodded off under a general spell of satiety, as if I'd successfully counted whole numbers steadily all the way up to infinity, and though tired, quite confident that given a moment's rest, I might easily count backwards again from there in just roughly half the time. But time tallies accounts jealously, my Patroclus. Once here, then gone. She ekes out any swindles from her share with the cruelest interest here again, lost once more, and turns afternoon slumbers into vengeful justifications of accounts pending, once here, then gone, where horizons of lost incense are held tangled amongst uncountable arms, reaching back in streaming trails of years, decades, then centuries, moments, ages, eons. And there I find you, my unblinking sitter subject, alive and not stone, here before me on the same tragic summer afternoon. While long, slow turn of your bearded head, a bird rushes by, stops, chirps a little song, then flutters past again. You, at my age now, on a long walk after a short day. You, remembering a slow, ponderous love, lost much too quickly. A quick stripe of lightning, and I see you judging its distance by the weight in between, smiling wisely, the slow rumbling ache of thunder. You, recalling the strange, seemingly lost time of battle, alternating between infinite immediacies, instantaneous eternities, a little finch flutters up, sets up nest in your beard, lays its eggs, sits on them a while, brings the squealing babies wet worms and soft bugs, sees them fly off on their own, leaves herself, and then is back again next year, and then the next, and the next, and the next. And you, a boy, sink into sleep on a night so many, many long, long thousands of years ago that time herself cannot even begin to mourn it or even trace it. And yet here again, I sleep again, I wake again, I blink. Days pass with only paper to record lost afternoons, and stone, it records lostness itself. The book continues, but I'll end here, and it continues, I would say, photographically in reverse, back to its beginning. Okay, so I've taken more than my 10 minutes, and I wanted to give the podium over to Sarah Hamill. Thank you.
What does it mean to translate an original into a copy, to transform a material object into a free-floating image, to reconcile, as Jeffrey Batchin frames these questions in his catalog essay, the world of three-dimensional things with a creative reconstitution of that world in the form of a two-dimensional picture? My talk today orients us to how modern sculptors responded to this set of questions. Faced with a world in which the technologies of reproduction were increasingly used as a form of display, how did they negotiate the difficult task of translation, of reconstituting thing into image, spatial material into picture? These artists, and they include Rodin, Brancusi, and Smith, whose works are on the screen and included in the show, but also Merardo Rosso, Pablo Picasso, Henry Moore, and Alberto Giacometti, each photographed their sculptures themselves or worked closely with professional photographers to do so. The stories surrounding their respective turns to photography echo a common refrain. Each retained control over their sculpture's public life in an image, to sometimes folkloric effect. Brancusi, it is said, threw from his studio any person who photographed his work without permission, permission he, in fact, rarely gave. Each sculptor, too, was self-trained, meaning that their photographic mistakes were purposeful. David Smith, for one, rejected the well-meaning but unsolicited advice of his dealer to make his photographs more suitable for the magazine Boys and Girls, she wrote. Brancusi, too, received complaints of his lack of skill from Brassai. Such comments fell on deaf ears. This was because in these sculptors' hands, photography was not only a way to display their works beyond the studio. It was much more than this, an independent art form in its own right. The jurisdiction these artists held over the final print tells us as much, but so do the results themselves, photographs that went against the grain of a documentary photography. soft, even lighting, frontal vantage points, neutral backdrops. These conventions, here glimpsed in the illustrations in Carl Einstein's 1920 book, Nigger Plastique, went out the window. So too did the implications that these tactics carried, mainly that a sculptural object was meant to be visible and easily digested in a photograph, even though these images gave little information about an object's size or its material makeup. For these modernists, however, photography was not, by and large, a means to visibility or likeness. It was a medium in its own right, something that could block as much as it could reveal, as do Brancusi's flashes of light and double exposures, images that confound our perception of sculpture by materializing the photographic process. Photography, too, was something that could alter and change the object. As David Smith's photographs suggest, on the left, an early 1930s photo collage, on the right, a 1951 image of Australia. It was a way to direct a perception of sculpture, to encounter it in the setting of an assemblage of objects, so that sculpture became part of a pictorial framework. Or it was to compress the sculpture altogether through a low vantage point, to see it as if it were a linear, groundless form against a sky. These photographs unsettle sculpture. They ask us to see it anew, in an alternate setting, or through an unconventional point of view, one, in fact, that Smith termed under eye level, suggesting the mobile and non-embodied points of view he ascribed to his camera. So focusing on a few key works for the remaining time that I have, I'd like to isolate these two factors, or how sculptors use photography to supply their objects with a setting or a point of view. So consider a set of photographs authored by Drouet, which we've seen in brief in Roxana's presentation. These were made in consultation with Rodin, and a sheet serves as backdrop and prop for a work titled The Clenched Hand, which was likely made as a study for the hands of the burghers of Calais. Drapery in the images both hides and reveals the hand, bringing bronze to life. Yet it is the vantage points used, I think, to frame the scene that completes the animation. In one view, on the left, Drouet has envisioned the hand as if it were the photographer's, or now the viewer's own, sponsoring a process of identification. In another, the camera frames the hand from a distance. It thrusts out of the cloth, a detached other. In a third view, on the right, the hand seems to claw its way out of the drapery, or, as Rodin allegedly himself had it, the hand was now a primordial monster creeping over desert sands. Whatever our chosen analogy here, the hand in this image is not a hand at all. It is an amputated part, its ghostly limb retrieved in the painting on the wall behind it. What these photographic frames present are three wholly distinct visions of the same sculpture. Identification, detachment, repulsion. Each view supplies the object with a different set of pictorial characteristics, almost a different sculpture. Taken together, they call attention to the instabilities of sculptural viewing. Form is unfixed. It is variable and endlessly renewable, as Kirk Varnadeau described Rodin's aesthetic. Yet here, those qualities are photographically intoned. Vantage point is contradictory and changing. It is not the singular, stable view that Heinrich Wolflin recommended in an 1896 essay on photography, which is also cited in the catalog for the exhibition. It was a treatise that aimed to standardize and restrict the points of view available to photographers of sculpture. Not so for Rodin. Like the intimate up-close vantages used by Medardo Rosso or the low views exploited by Smith, point of view unfixes the object. It sponsors a dynamic encounter. So there was a second way in which modern sculptors used the camera to unhinge their objects, and that is through setting, or how sculptors imagined their objects in a range of spaces. It would be hard to miss the evocative ways in which Brancusi transformed his studio into a pleasant geometric dream, as one contemporaneous viewer had it. In these photographs, which were published frequently in Brancusi's lifetime, sculptures stand amidst blocks of stone and wood, which were props for the scene. The photographs animate sculpture, seeing it as part of an archaeological ruin or some futuristic space. Other settings were called on too. There was Rodin Steichen's Moonlit Garden, in which the controversial sculpture of Balzac was monumentalized as a commanding, dramatic form. Or there were Henry Moore's English Fields on the left, which served as a naturalizing setting for his reclining figure, a work that is, if you can believe it, only 13 inches in length, but that in a trick of scale, of photographic scale, seems colossal, as if on par with the landscape. Or, in another mode, there was David Smith's Lake George Dock on the right, an incongruous setting for his tank totem sculptures. In this photograph, the collision of a human and pastoral space with abstract welded steel objects points up his sculpture's abstraction, their non-belonging to their surroundings. Now, what I've just shown you is an abundance of spaces for the modernist object. It is an abundance that is telling in its own right. Using the camera, sculptors could dream up a range of pictorial identities for their objects. They could be flexible in their visions, dislodging sculpture from the here and now, pretending it to be nomadic and open, imagining it in a range of settings or from a variety of points of view. Seen in a sculptor's photograph, the modernist object is destabilized. It is both a material, original thing, and its projection in an image, both durable and ephemeral. The story of how modern sculptors took hold of the mechanisms of reproduction, then, is a story about the unsettling of sculpture. What these photographs suggest, in other words, is an unraveling of our most familiar narratives about modern sculpture. What are we to make, for instance, of readings of sculptural autonomy or homelessness, that key trope for the 20th century, when such qualities of self-sufficiency or independence are written into the plane of the photographic image, so much a part of a sculpture's rhetoric and display? What, too, of medium specificity, that century-old truth? How are we to make sense of sculpture's reliance on other mediums, its tangibility shot through with a provisional form of address, its originality contingent on the copy? These questions, and I realize they're large ones, remain open. What is clear is that photography and sculpture intertwined, and there is a coda to this history. While the recent photography of sculpture sometimes has the effect of dissolving sculptural matter altogether, where, for instance, is the enduring object to be found in a Fischlian Weiss photograph? For these modernists, object and image were two sides of the same coin. Even as they used the camera to animate their objects, their photographs still held on to the promise of sculpture. Objects matter, Brancusi's photographs suggest. They are a vital part of a ruin. Thanks. So I'd like to invite Rachel up.
Hi, and thank you to Roxana and everyone. I'm here to talk about my photographic piece called Voyage of the Beagle, which is comprised of 57 photographs. So what's on view here is, you know, most, but not all of it. And I thought what I could do tonight is overshare how it was made rather than what it all means, since we have these other people who can do that. So I'm going to start here in Corsica, where I did not intend to begin my Voyage of the Beagle. This is an 11th century church I went to look at for no particular reason. And I had bought my first point-and-shoot digital camera for this trip because I could take lots of pictures and I could just look at things and not really be too bothered about it. These are out of order. And I don't have a lot of time, so this is not my PowerPoint. Okay, so that's supposed to be the second picture, which is part of that church, and we'll wing it. So there are things that you see that you don't expect to see. And then there are things that you're looking for. So one of the things is I had decided to take the trip to Corsica before knowing what was there. And one of the things that's there is a lot of prehistoric standing stones that are also called menhirs. So I began to read about those and get very interested in them in terms of their depiction of the figurative and how now what remains, and I think we just saw one, is just entirely abstract. And it would, you know, and one of the things that's great when you try to read about things, especially in places in the world where there aren't large universities with a large archaeological department or things where research would come out of it, they say, well, we really don't know what they're for. We really don't know why they were here. You know, they could be talking to aliens. They could have been kept, they could have scared off the Vikings. I really don't know. So are we sure this is my PowerPoint? Because they're completely out of order. Okay, so that's the church. And what I wanted to do was talk a little about being in situ, to see things in a setting. So I visited menhirs in different parts of the island of Corsica. And the first place I went was a place where the menhir had actually been found in another location and moved to be in front of a church. Huh, thank God it's here. Okay, so you can see here three standing stones that were placed by someone who thought that they should be near a church. And since we don't really know what these things were for initially, the fact that they would suddenly be in a place of a religious orientation was also interesting to me. Oh, good, it's right. Okay, so... So I wasn't photographing these for any particular reason except to help me remember them or because I like to take lots of pictures. And when I got back from the trip, I did notice that in addition to photographing them where they were living, I also tried to identify their forms in a very straightforward, formal way. So again, this is precedes any of my thinking about the photographic work on view. It was just the pictures of my trip. Another site, Philotosa, on the island of Corsica. This is an interesting place because it was the only place that we found, and again, there could be others, I don't know, where the person who owned the land where the menhirs existed decided to sort of turn it into a theme park around it and charge admission. So that was kind of nice in contrast to the previous site I just showed you. So this is the site of Philotosa. These are people walking around. Not a lot of rain. It's a little bit dry. I became particularly interested in the lights that were meant to be camouflaged on the far left, a lot of which were no longer working. So I actually, in looking back into my pictures to prepare for this talk tonight and my oversharing, I have like 100 pictures of things like this. I'll never do anything with them, so I'm happy to overshare. This I like. What's behind the sculpture? We can ask Richard Hawkins. My dear friend. And then another example of my desire, without any consciousness, to isolate the figure. So I'd like to read now a quote from Darwin. "I discovered, though unconsciously and insensibly, that the pleasure of observing and reasoning was a much higher one than that of skill and sport." A picture makes 1,000 words. I don't have a lot of things. I don't have to say that's original. Okay, so I like gift shops. I like art for sale. So the setting was important, you know, to find the thing in the place and to find all the things that could happen that you could do with this thing that no one really knows what it's for. So now we get to yet another site. I'm going to show you 4 sites in total. Really regret not buying the T-shirt. But it's good to see where these things live, right? Because when you see it on the walls of MoMA, and I'll get to that for a second, maybe the rupture that was mentioned earlier or the continuity that was then reflected upon as being unrelated to the rupture, because I think that you have both things simultaneously, it's kind of interesting. Maybe I'm more interested in the poles and the fence than I am in the thing. One of the things that's interesting about these also is that you can see there's a sword, so maybe some of them are warriors. The carving within it that remains in certain places, it would suggest, in addition to the figuration, some kind of iconic things about symbols and power that became of interest to me. So my favorite site was having to park the car in something that I thought that we were like, maybe this is the parking lot, and then walk down a dirt road without any signs to find this sign, to find this site. So that was really nice. And then to go back to the point and shoot. You can just take lots of pictures of the same thing over and over again. So again, I don't know if these are these manures. Are they also meant to ward off the aliens and Vikings at the same time? So again, my discovery here was also, thinking about what does sculpture communicate? Why are people making sculptures? I make more sculptures than I do, and I think of myself as an artist, so it's I'm post-medium or whatever that is, but it's something that I go back and forth in terms of thinking of space, in terms of putting things in space, and then documenting them in space, and then how photography always adds to that language. So this kind of lack of order, the need, for me to suddenly order it with a camera, if you see the one right at the top with the lichen, okay, so that's that one. And what I had done, and what should be happening now in the poor PowerPoint, is that you would see the Voyage of the Beagle in its entirety. So what I did was, so what I would ask is, what do you do with this picture? You put it next to this. So why do I put these two pictures next to each other? This could then be the next question one would ask. So what does it mean about the figurative? What does it mean about the meaning of the object and how the object conveys something? This is in a wig shop on Hollywood Boulevard in Los Angeles. Who is this wig for? You know, is the hair for sale on the chest? Because I want some. Fifth Avenue, New York City. Oh, okay, that's in order. So yeah, so this is an object that I photographed that I put in sequence. And then this is the next photograph that follows. So sequencing is something that I thought a lot in terms of making this work in its entirety. And what does it mean to order these photographs? And what does it mean that one would follow the next? And what are the spaces that they're in? So sometimes it was as simple as the backgrounds. I got interested in putting the backgrounds together. And I'll go back to that for a second. Again, these are out of order. So this is to show the sculpture. So I made the Voyage of the Beagle. Get back, I've got these pictures of veneers, what am I going to do? I'm going to photograph things in my world as I walk around without any purpose to use my new point-and-shoot camera, which was not very many megapixels, and I could keep it in my bag, and I would never go looking for anything. I would just, if I saw something, then I would take a picture of it. So I made it specifically for this body of work called If I Did It. All the photographs were on the wall in a line, and then each sculpture was named after someone. So on the left, we have Rainer Werner Fassbinder, Fats Domino, Pascal Paoli, and Alexander the Great. So those four figures, I would think the one that most people here wouldn't know is Pascal Paoli. So Pascal Paoli was a very important leader in Corsica. And that's Johnny Depp, and then this is the Voyage of the Beagle. So what I had done in the PowerPoint was I had had a bunch of them in a row, so that one on the left, and then the ram, and then Gertrude Stein, and then the angel. So let's see if those come back. Oh, they do. Okay. So this is also now just because I like to do this. Sorry. Oh, that wasn't good. All right. Views documenting the same work because it's always a body in space walking around the sculptures. So that's the beginning because I had to have a beginning. So in the beginning, God created the earth, animals, Gertrude Stein, and religion. How did I order them? Why did I put them together? What is this sequence? Am I telling you the truth? And here, again, I use this as an example because it's the first four photographs in the first series, and I've gone on to unfortunately make two more. But you can see how the background of real mountains in Corsica seem to work well with the ones that everyone in New York knows in the Museum of Natural History and Bryant Park and a cemetery in Queens. And besides kind of physically orienting these objects in their spaces, some real, some imagined, there's also the issue of scale that became of interest to me in terms of these sequences. So, how big is Gertrude Stein when she looks like the Buddha? And those Buddha sculptures you see in Chinese restaurants, they come in all different sizes. And so there's this other thing that I've been trying to do with these headshots and putting them together, and what does that cumulatively tell you about your own body when you're looking at it? I'm going to just briefly, and become aware of the time, briefly mention something about the linguist Noam Chomsky's, whose work on transformational grammar and hierarchical rules of governance is something that came as an afterthought while I was working on it. So for those of you who know about that and think about those things, I do think about syntax and I do think about deep structure in putting these together more If I Did It, an object in If I Did It. So in terms of the body of work of me, those photographs, that piece, I kind of thought, it's a throwaway. I'm going to show it with my sculptures that I take seriously, because then it's some kind of index archive of how I think about the objects in the world and the objects that I use in my sculpture, how I think about representation, Barbies in fur coats, head off the computer screen at the Met's Head in Medieval Stone show, I think it was called, one of the best shows I saw in New York. More Fassbender, and then I'd like to just end with three examples of other artists' work that were inspirations for me to make this piece. So, you know, I think that it's inherent in the medium of photography that you work in series. And you could say that about painting, you can say that about sculpture, but I actually don't really make sculptures in series. I make them in bodies of work, and I make projects. So sculpture lends itself to series, so I was trying to think about, like, who really made series that meant things to me. And the first one I came up with that I think I thought about the most was Michael Schmidt's Unity, so the German artist. So these are three pictures from that. And in his project, some of them are pictures that he took, and some of them are appropriated or taken from newspapers. So that's an interesting project to me. Another one we all know and love is Martha Rosler. And language and poetry and things that I think also George mentioned, you know, kind of come with this. And then also humor. I find this work very funny, which is important to me. And then the piece I'm going to close with is Angola to Vietnam by Christopher Williams, which are photographs he had taken of the glass flowers at the Harvard Museum. And in sequencing those, he actually used a system. So his system, and I had to look it up on Wikipedia, because I always forget. So it's the 27 countries where disappearances and human rights abuses were known to have occurred, according to a 1986 report issued by the Commission on International Humanitarian Issues. So I find this piece very, very powerful because of the politics behind it. I really love this piece as well. There are 27 photographs, and I also like that he then arranged them alphabetically. So thank you, and I would like to now introduce the curator, Tate from the curator. Blah, blah, blah. Mark Godfrey, thank you.
Well, thank you very much to Roxana for inviting me and to everyone else who's spoken for your fascinating talks. And luckily there's a link between Rachel's and mine in as much as we both got Christopher Williams in there. But in other respects, they're very, very different. So my talk's called Four Knots. It's in four very small sections. I guess there's a tie between the first two and the last two. In her catalogue essay, Roxana writes about the sculptural projects from the late 60s as undertaking a social analysis of the urban environment. With this phrase in mind, I want to chart four moments in art history since the late 60s where such social analyses have taken place, each involving different relationships of sculpture and photography, though in the last two cases it's more the global rather than the urban environment that interests me, and it's the situation of objects in this environment. So we'll start with Richard Serra, who by 69 was wondering whether sculpture could find a critical place in the city without becoming a decoration for a corporate plaza or a monument for a civic cause. And this was one of the first sculptures that he made outside the gallery. And you can see it's titled there, so I won't read it. And it was installed in the Bronx in 1970. Now, there were complex relationships between its two halves and between its circular form and the street's linear trajectory. But as Douglas Crimp wrote, it was Serra's misconception that anyone from the art world was interested enough in sculpture to venture into that, quote, sinister outpost in the Bronx. The work existed in precisely the form in which earthworks exist for most people, as photographs. Now, for Serra, it was a great problem that any sculpture would become pictorial, so it was even more troubling that a work that he would make could be known to others in a photograph. So he didn't like this at all, but I've always been fascinated by this photograph and the placement of the sculpture between the two vacant lots and the way that the photograph, maybe without wanting to, documented the dereliction of this part of the city at this time. Because if Serra didn't seek to address this dereliction, other sculptors would soon after. Now, the first of these was Hans Hacker, who the next year produced Schapolsky et al. Again, a longer title you can read. Now, while some have thought of this work as marking a transition from Hacker's work as a sculptor, for instance, the phase of the condensation cube, to his work as a conceptual artist, as Benjamin Buchlow has convincingly recently argued, Hacker at this point was reconceiving sculpture as a practice not so much about the spatial relationships of objects and viewers, but as one concerned with different ideas of space, public space, architectural space, institutional space, and so on. Buchlow proposes, therefore, a category of sculpture as photography. Hacker could produce an archive of photographs and of texts, making a sculptural project which looked at how private spaces of homes were brought and sold publicly, were brought and sold by publicly listed companies. Working in the public space of the archive and the street, Hacker could chart this system and redefine sculptural practice at the same time. Now, I've always been interested in how Hacker arranged the photographs quite sculpturally in the installations of this piece, encircling the viewer with a band of images. But a more daring sculptural installation of photographs was plotted out soon after by Gordon Matter Clark on the occasion of his invitation to contribute to the exhibition Idea as Model at the Institute for Architecture and Urban Resources in 1976. Matter Clark took these photographs of shattered windows of dilapidated Bronx project houses and installed these images in the windows of the Institute, which he'd shot out of their, he'd shot out these windows to create the frames. And there aren't any images of this actual installation because it was kind of closed down the day he did it. In creating this very sculptural intervention, Matter Clark was using photography strategically rather than accepting it, as Sarah had, begrudgingly. As Thomas Crowe has noted, Matter Clark was concerned with the housing conditions of the city for the city's poor and begging the question why these conditions were hardly addressed by the most radical architects of the time. Now, what we're seeing in these two latter projects, whether we see them primarily as sculptural arrangements of photographs or as photographic projects addressing new sculptural issues about public and private space, is that the coming together of sculpture and photography released both mediums from their former means of analysing the urban environment. Such analyses would have been conducted by documentary photographers or by the builders of civic monuments to civic causes, for instance. Now, if we think of the situation of sculpture in the decade after the emergence of these projects, it initially seems that their radical inquiries were being put to one side as sculptors once again set about making rather conventional objects and displaying them in galleries. However, we can also locate the beginning of a new relationship between photography and sculpture. Sculptors using photography to designate everyday objects and material situations in the city as sculpture. Or perhaps this isn't so new, but a continuation or a change of the idea of involuntary sculpture from Dali and Bressai, or indeed of the Becker's designation of industrial buildings as anonymous sculptures. Now, we see this phenomenon emerging around the same time in the UK and in Germany. The British artist I have in mind is Richard Wentworth, whose photographic series Making Do and Getting By comprises provisional arrangements of objects created most often to fulfil basic functions like propping open a window or a door or reserving a parking space, creating a ramp for a trolley, protecting a dodgy staircase from intruders, etc. The German artist is Raymond Kummer, whose series Sculptures in the Street from 1978 is an 80-part slide piece. Kummer's photographs are particularly interesting because he seems to have used the camera to find arrangements which recall all kinds of 60s sculpture. For instance, works by Carl André, Rainer Ruthenbeck. This one's another sort of André homage, I guess. And in one of the images, I think, although I haven't actually been able to verify this, I think he's designating as sculptural the site where Richard Serra's Berlin block was about to be placed in 78. Now, it could seem that the social analysis of the urban environment no longer takes place here, but I think that's not quite the case. And to explain why, it's interesting to contrast the two photographic projects. Wentworth seems to see the sculptural in homemade arrangements, while Coomer designates as sculptural the unfinished midway points of civic building efforts. So without it being their first intention, Coomer's photographs witness the efforts of Berlin to modernise itself, and you might say that digging up the pavement seems a means of not digging up the past. Meanwhile, Wentworth's images show a country in economic recession, where grand plans often make way for temporary provisional solutions. There's Coomer again. And here's one of my favourite of the Wentworths, where, and this is actually on Tower Bridge, you know, a really ceremonial, important part of London, where presumably a broken area of the railing on the bridge can be patched up by a slab of wood held in place by a pile of shingle dumped by a truck. Now, this idea of photography designating urban material situations as sculptural has continued in recent times, with the most prominent practitioner being Gabriel Orozco. But Orozco's fellow Mexico City-based artist Francis Aliste has also worked in this way, even though he's better known for video documentation of sculptural actions. For instance, for formal reasons, we could compare Orozco's extension of reflection from this work of Francis Aliste's The Moment Where Sculpture Happens. But as well as designating found situations as sculptural ones, both artists also have made alterations and interventions in urban situations and used photography to document them. Gabriel Orozco's arrangements of tins of cat food and watermelons that are in the show. But what's interesting about Elise's works is how close his inquiries were to those of Mata Clark and Hans Hacker. So in 1990, he placed pillows in broken windows and photographed them. The intervention targeted the failure of the Mexican government to respond adequately to the damage done to housing in the 1986 earthquake. And a few years later, he produced a second piece which reflected on the inadequate response of all Mexico's political parties to the housing crisis. So he took a number of political posters from different parties, which often were actually photographs of leaders, sewed them together to form a rectangular sheet and constructed a temporary shelter by letting this sheet be inflated by the rising air coming out of the vents of a subway on the Zocalo. And this installation was actually done on the election day when it's illegal to exhibit any political poster within the Zocalo. Now, Elise photographed the intervention, and with what George was talking about at the beginning, photography's potential for not being original, for just spreading and reproducing, he produced a postcard of this photograph, and that's the way in which this project was dispersed and disseminated. Now I come to chapter three, which is a number of recent photographic projects from the past 10 years, which I think are kind of related, which I wanted to discuss. Specifically, there's Jean-Luc Moulin's Product of Palestine, Christopher Williams, for example, 18 Leçons, Zoe Leonard's Analogue, and Taryn Simon's Contraband, but I won't be talking about the last two, but I think they're kind of interesting to throw into the mix. Now, for the most part, the subjects of these photographs aren't sculpted works of art. Instead, they're objects, new products, old ones, and so on. But I think that these photographic projects are relevant to this discussion about photography of sculpture for a number of reasons. First of all, because a number of them are made by artists who are equally involved with sculpture as photography. But secondly, and more importantly, because I think it's a legitimate concern of the practice of sculpture today to investigate the global production, circulation, and consumption of objects. And as Lawrence Wiener has said, sculpture addresses the relationship between human beings and objects to objects in relation to human beings. So understanding this circulation is a sculptural issue. Now, Moulin worked on the Products of Palestine series from 2002 to 2005. He photographed some products which we might well imagine were produced in the occupied territories, such as olive oil, and otherwise other ones which remind us that multinational companies have franchises even in austere regions, so these Coke bottles, for instance. Rather poignantly, we might imagine that these objects are not exported outside Palestine and only circulate in Moulin's images. He photographed most of the objects against neutral backgrounds, but with whatever photographic means were readily available in the territories. The series was begun around the same time, so there's a couple more, and often they're paired, so paired structures in some way reflecting on the sort of Israeli-Palestinian pairing in that region. So Williams's series was begun around the same time, and this includes images of a large variety of objects, so bicycles, hair curlers, shower doors, post packets, car tires, and so on. He uses the apparatus of the photography industry to make pictures of these objects. For instance, he will hire a specialist lighting person, a cameraman, etc. And the objects appear on their own, very neutrally. And we also learn through textual supplements about their history. For instance, that this tire was made using rubber produced in Vietnam, but was also the kind of tire that would have been used in the barricades in Paris in May 68 to protest the war in Vietnam, amongst other things. Superficially, there seem to be some connections between Moulin's and Williams's projects. Both artists photographed products in photographic studios, for instance, and both are interested in the histories of the objects, where they were made and how they're circulated. But the differences are interesting too. For Moulin, a photographic series can connect disparate objects together to their place of production in order to reflect on the dire situation of Palestine and of the immobility of these objects. Williams, however, uses photography's muteness to represent the disconnection of objects, producers, and consumers today. And he does this by giving us all this information that we could possibly need about each object, but really separating the information from the photograph itself, and often installing the photograph so very different objects appear next to each other with complete disconnection between them. Now, I'd like to finish. Here are the images I'm not talking about, but maybe there might be time in the discussion. I'd like to finish with the recent project of Simon Starling's, Starling being an artist who ties photography and sculpture together in increasingly complex knots. Invited to exhibit in Mass MoCA in 2008, Starling undertook archival research in the area, and the outcome of which was the discovery of a photograph from 1875 which showed a group of migrant Chinese labourers in the North Adams area outside a shoemaking factory. And these had been some of the first Chinese immigrants on the east coast of the United States. Now, Starling has often treated a photograph as a material object and not just as an informational image. For instance, he'll be interested in whether a photograph has been made with platinum or gold or silver, where these metals would have been mined, and how the ores were transported to the place where the photograph was produced. In this case, he proceeded in this project by combining an inquiry about the materiality of the archival photograph with an inquiry into its subject matter. He took a tiny fragment of the archival image of the labourers and looked at the silver crystals in the photographic emulsion under a microscope. Having created three-dimensional images of two of these crystals, he then commissioned the construction of two sculptures, which were blow-ups of these crystals. The sculptures were fabricated in the country of the 19th century labourer's origin, China. The resulting objects have a passing resemblance to the highly reflective blobs that Anish Kapoor has been famed for, but in this case, Starling's sculptures are generated from a photograph and produced by the photographic process of enlargement. The sculptures were shipped over to Mass MoCA. Starling housed them in a large space in the museum, which one could enter through a wall, on which he displayed this large blow-up image of the sculpture. And actually, you entered the second space where the sculptures were through these two holes, which corresponded to the area where he'd taken the crystals from. And another outcome of the project was a set of photographs of the sculpture that Starling had made in the fabrication plant in China, showing the workers in that factory reflected in the sculpture's undulating surfaces. It's a group of images. And of course, they brought to mind today when I walked through the show again, the Brancusi image, which Starling would have known well. Starling raises a vast number of difficult questions with this project. If a photograph can be a mnemonic object and can recall conditions of production from a historical era that is now all but forgotten, is sculpture by now instead condemned to being an amnesiac art of urban decoration, as in Kapoor's work? Why is it that so many of the most popular and indeed most photogenic sculptures today have so little to say about the place of their situation and production? Or can a sculpture produced out of a photograph take something from photography's mnemonic capacities? Might an artist reflect on the conditions of the production of objects, sculptures, and photographs today, or are the circuits of global production too complex for representation? Now, on the one hand, Starling makes very clear connections in his project between China and mass mocha, between 1875 and 2008. But on the other, the near illegibility of the image that you see now allegorizes the near total opacity of the conditions that Starling has chosen to address. So this photograph is a photograph of a sculpture is a photograph of reflections, but almost incomprehensible ones. And that's it. Thank you. And if everyone can come up.
I realize that we all went over the allotted time, beginning with me. And so I am ready to open this to the room if there are urgent questions. And if not, I'll be happy to pick it up with the line of thoughts that have been discussed so far. Any questions? No questions. Okay. Well, I found it absolutely fascinating, all the talks and the sort of overlaps in certain cases. And if I were to summarize, which I don't know if I'm supposed to do that, maybe I should just ask everyone if there were one question, you know, that you would like this exhibition to answer, what would it be? I certainly learned a number of things from your talks. Not that I would change necessarily anything in the exhibition from it, but things that are at the core of the show. For instance, how, if we were to take Sarah's talk, how modernist sculptors were sort of almost dematerializing sculpture in order to make photography more of an object-like. And, you know, when you look at Brancusi or at the Simon Starling, for that matter, blur in the sculpture, that blur doesn't really exist in the sculpture. It only exists in the photograph. So in a way, you sort of dematerialize or explode, you know, that particular sculpture in order to offer an object-like quality to the photographs, or the kind of, regardless of whether the voyage of the Beagle was taken just as a kind of point and shoot, you know, in the end, the sequencing and the shifts in scale that seem to be so important, or the backgrounds. This is just photography that does that. But then it's the whole sort of also maybe the local stories and the global narratives, you know, of the photograph. I mean, where who is making it and how is it circulated and how is ore transformed into platinum prints and other such concerns. And then Richard Hawkins who I actually haven't thought about it in the context of the show, but who is raises so many interesting issues because while you were talking about the treatise of posteriority, or he was talking about it, and as a sort of an alternate form of frontality, mm-hmm. or about the back of the image and things like that, I was thinking of one of the first, you know, discussions, Wölfflin's, you know, discussion about how a photograph, how a sculpture ought to be photographed, and that was a very normative kind of a view, which was a frontal view. And then also I was wondering while I was listening to you whether, and the whole sort of expenditure of desire that goes, or mourning or melancholia that goes into these pictures. And I was thinking that Hawkins was someone who studied in the 80s, because you really emerged in the 90s. I mean, you are the expert on Hawkins, right?
But, but you're right.
And then I was thinking of Leo Steinberg. You know, I was thinking of Leon Steinberg because it was in the early 80s that he published, I don't remember the exact title, but I think it was something, The Sexuality of Christ, mm-hmm.
In Renaissance art and in the modern oblivion.
Yeah. And it was a modern oblivion because everybody obliterated to talk about an aspect that was so blatantly in your face, you know, that alternate frontality, the sexuality of Christ that, you know, holding the penis, gesturing at it, having it erect. And you know, the whole Urbis Paganus, the city of pagans, of anuses, maybe you would like to call it, since you pointed out to that etymology. But, you know, that's what Steinberg has done. He has shown that there was this tradition within the history of art for the ostentatio vulnerum, which was like showing Christ's wounds. Mm-hmm. And then he showed, well, there is this alternate, you know, also never discussed, always sort of censored tradition of the ostentatio genitalium, which I think... I mean, I don't know if this comes anywhere in the literature that you've researched or not.
Well, I think it's really interesting to think about with the project that I was showing. But one difference would be, I mean, I don't know what Renaissance historians ultimately have made of Leo Steinberg's beautiful book, but the Richard Hawkins piece is definitely an attempt to invent a kind of history that may have very little relationship to actual historical, art historical and historical conditions. But the many reasons for that invention, of course, but the one that I was interested in and try to foreground tonight is an allegorization of forms, mm-hmm. that they would find their relationship worked out in an erotic fantasy around artworks, actually. Whether that has any art historical validity is not, I think, the argument of that piece, as I think it is for Steinberg, right? So... there's that difference. Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought about that book. It's great to think about it in relationship to this project. He's a great reader of our history. So,
well, he started as an art, a critic or an art historian, of, right? We were talking about Hawkins at being someone who really started as a critical. Is this on? Yeah. And then turning to, you know, to become an artist. But so, you know, there is all this beletristic, you know, as you've seen, you know, he's a narrator in addition of being an artist. And
I ask a question of you?
Yeah.
And this is maybe in the spirit of Rachel oversharing her process, but I just wanted to hear, just as on the level of general information, more about
the impulses that drove you as a curator to focus on this issue of photography and sculpture? I mean, I think we're all interested in it in different ways.
It's very sort of simple, you know. I wrote my dissertation on Brancusi. And it was on the sculpture. It wasn't on the photography aspect. But when you read the literature on Brancusi, on his sculpture, he's often presented as a sort of a Platonist kind of an artist, as an artist of pure form. Sort of a sui generis. And when you look at the photograph, you get a very different understanding of his work. And so, you know, the two type of examples that I gave, the sort of photo lumineuse where he's really calculating the angle of incidence on how the light falls onto the sculpture to sort of explode the gestalt, you know, shows another aspect of Brancusi, not just the perfect form, but, you know, his interest in infinity, which were realized through polishing techniques, but also through a sort of kineticism and movement. And he's much more, you know, on his scenographic approach. You know, when Brancusi died the year before dying in April 1956, was less than a year before he died, he bequested the holdings of his studio to the French government with the stipulation that they recreate the studio as it was, and that's why we have the Renzo Piano, you know, now place outside of the Pompidou right on the grounds. And this scenographic, you know, aspect of the of his interest, you know, when he first came in 1926 to the States, he came by boat as people were coming then, and then seeing the sort of skylight of New York, he said, well, this is my studio. Those pictures that, you know, Sarah was showing with the stage boulders, it's how he really envisioned the studio as an amalgam of shifting forms that he would permutate, and the permutations were made for the camera. And there are many stories of how reluctant he was, you know, to sell his works towards the end of his life and recreating plaster, you know, cast of sculpture that would eventually leave the studio, and if it was a gray marble, he would paint it in gray marble just to have, you know, that place, because in the end it became sort of a stage set for him. When Scott Barton did the first artist choice at MoMA, he did it on Brancusi. It was called My Brancusi. And for the first time, he showed Brancusi in a way that
When was that?
In 89 or something around there. And it was a very institutional way of showing Brancusi. It was shown based on the photographs part of it. It was shown that the importance of the base in the work, because bases were shown next to the works. And he was talking about Brancusi's photographs as a sort of Duchampian set, you know. So although I wrote on the sculpture, I understood him through the photographs. And that was my starting point for the show.
Okay. So something about...
Questions from the public. I knew that would come.
That's good.
Yes.
Okay. Really interesting talks. And I have something to say about a few, but I really want to ask Mark Gottfried a question about the Starling work that you talked about. It's very interesting work, and thanks for explaining it. It strikes me that there's a procedural aspect to the work, meaning that the way that, at least I think you explained it, there were archival photographs from the 1870s that were found. He microscopically picked out these crystals and then had them made in, quote-unquote, the country of origin. So there's, to me, to my mind, a very interesting and, I think, provocative story that is told about the migrant labor in, you know, in New England at the time, and how that sort of circles back to a contemporary situation where China, or, you know, because it has the capacity and also cheap labor, would be producing works for Urs Fischer as well as Simon Starling. But it seems to me that there's a sort of overdetermined aspect to this procedural thinking, in the sense that if one were to look at a crystal from a photograph from the 1870s of anything, a plant, you know, I don't know, a church, whatever it would be, you would find the same kind of crystal. And therefore, the idea of returning it to the country of origin, you know, would have been, I think, compromised, you know, at least in this type of procedural reading. Now, I'm not critiquing the work per se, but I'm interested in the thinking of origin in relationship to procedure in this reasoning. I wonder if you have something to say about that.
Well, thanks for the question. I should say that he sort of works in series, although doesn't really show the works ever in the same spot. But this may have been the fifth or so project where he'd done this kind of thing of taking a crystal and turning it into a sculpture, turning a photograph into a sculpture. And in the other occasions, he hadn't looked into the process that you summarized of reflecting on where the production of that sculpture took place. So it was only on this occasion when... so, you know, for instance, I think in a previous project, he had made a work about a Man Ray photograph, and similarly, it's a slide piece which zooms into a Man Ray photograph, which is a photograph of rock strata, and each progressive image goes closer and closer. The first one is on the racks of a museum wall. The last one is a microscopic image of a crystal. Again, if that work, you know, what that work does is it lets you reflect on the situation of the Man Ray on the museum storage facilities and then into its surface. But he doesn't think about the question of the relation to where his slides are produced, for instance, in that particular work. So it's just in this project where that going to China aspect of this took place. And the overdetermination is really deliberate, I think, on his part, that these narratives that he constructs through making these projects are always sort of ridiculous and unwieldy and provocative. But I'm not sure if that answers or goes some way.
I think there was another.
Yes. I guess I want to comment on the concept of the show rather than specific artists. All of the speakers touched on the one fact that these are altered states. The sculptures become altered states in a way. And is not all photography create an altered state? I mean, no matter what the subject or the object of the photograph. And so how is it different that these sculptures necessarily are transformed from the perspective in which we view them?
Who would like to answer the question?
I'd like to have an understanding of altered states.
Well, what I'm saying is it changes because we're looking at a three-dimensional object, and then we're not looking at a three-dimensional object. We're looking at what is two-dimensional within a different space. So that's I was trying to simplify, but maybe I didn't.
I thought there are very different kinds of experiences in the works of art in the show. I mean, I thought there were certain moments where what you're describing or what I think you're describing was exactly what I experienced, that the photograph of a sculpture is something entirely different than the sculpture, and the photograph seems to want to play up that difference. I experienced that a lot with the Brancusis, actually. Maybe not so much with the reflecting sculptures, but that there's such a dissonance between the Brancusi object and the Brancusi photography. That's really interesting to me. I'm not sure if that's what you mean by it. The photograph of a sculpture alters it already.
Sarah wants to answer
that. My answer to that question would be that viewing a sculpture is a very spatial and dynamic experience, and that every single view you look at a sculpture through, every single angle that you encounter a sculpture through is changing that sculpture. You're viewing a sculpture, you know, according to a variety of sculptors or according to sculptural aesthetics is a very spatialized experience, at least in the 20th century. Encountering in space, you're encountering in real space. So to photograph it means to control and to isolate and to kind of narrow that encounter to a single framework. I think that what's so interesting about this show is that you are encountering photographs that are kind of exploiting that problem and really pursuing a whole variety of vantage points. This Wolfflin essay has been mentioned a couple of times, and I think that's a really interesting essay because it designates a very specific vantage point through which you would encounter a sculpture, and that's not the case in so many of the images in the show. They're really kind of exploring a variety of ways in which sculpture can be encountered, but I also think that they're also exploiting or kind of laying bare the ways in which sculptures have been photographed and what those conventions are. I have a question for Rachel, actually, if you don't mind me kind of transitioning here, I guess, about her work, because I think that there's something really interesting in the ways that she's not only asking the question, what is sculpture, but what is the photography of sculpture? What are the conventions through which we see a sculpture through a photograph? How is it framed? How do we encounter these works through a variety of mediums? So I guess the question that I would ask you, Rachel, is that a part of how you're seeing your work? Is this kind of photographic framework, is the materiality of the photograph part of how you're seeing your work?
So I understand, what do you mean by materiality?
Well, okay, this also gets to some of your other photographs that are in MoMA.
Because those do.
Those
That's interesting.
Do.
I have other photographs on view that deal very much with like the ones re-photographing snapshots and things that are very much about the material presence, whereas this project is not about that for me. It's about the materials of the sculptures that are on view, but not the material of the photograph.
The reason that I'm asking is because I couldn't stop thinking about Malraux's Musée Imaginaire when I was looking at your piece, because he's applying the same framework, the same croppings, the same backgrounds, the same conventions for photographing, for displaying objects. And I was just wondering if that was a reference point for you.
That definitely wasn't a reference point, but I can say that other photographs that I'm happy that are on view right now at the same time in the museum, I was thinking about issues of materiality. I was thinking about framing. I mean, I'm going to be honest here. The Voyage of the Beagle, I wasn't trying to take good pictures. it was my first digital point-and-shoot. It was about this project where I wasn't even, you know, in the past I had shot exclusively with 35mm and develop everything and print them in the dark room and gone through all that. And this was like fast and easy, and so it was about something else. And what it became about, you know, might actually be more related to collage and putting the photo on top.
Yeah.
In which case, now that the photograph is dependent on the sculpture being present. But then my joke about the materials in the sculpture is that in sequencing them, like, I didn't want two plastic ones next to each other. Because there were things in there, you know, like if there's something that was carved in stone, it would be next to something then made of fur. And then so I would also, through the ages, depict without being thorough, with being purposefully irresponsible,
different materials as a catalog of manufacturing. Were I mean, but I don't know if anything was made in China. Okay. So. But I would bet 75% was.
Did you crop any of your photographs
no.
after you?
Okay, so I didn't do anything. They're really like point and shoot. Like what you see okay. was what you get. But you can take so many and choose the good ones.
Right.
So it's so fast. So it's a different process.
But I think the idea of the sequencing is something very photographic. I mean, you're yeah. mentioning yeah. that, and you know the examples that you were giving. Sequencing and classification to taxonomy. A certain degree, the taxonomies. Yeah, because you know you were talking about Christopher Williams from Vietnam to Angola, or, and I was thinking, well, you know what he did. What he did actually is that he changed one classificatory system, which was the botanical one that through which the plants were organized, with the political one. But it's another classificatory system. Yeah. It's not like yeah. he didn't do it, and it shows in a way the biased nature of any type of classification.
And he also changed the ordering from being chronological to based on alphabetizing them by the name of the. So there's two different systems.
Two different yeah. systems, and I guess in the process of doing that, in a way, he did get away from classification into analysis. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the other one was...
But Mark has something to say.
Yeah.
This is just maybe an unfair question, but I wanted to ask Roxana, if you'd have had another chapter and another room, what would the... And let's say you wanted to concentrate on work in the last 10 years without older examples, what would that have been? What sort of last chapter did you have that maybe you didn't have space for?
Jean-Luc Moulin, Christopher Sounds Williams, like. And Simon Starling.
I wasn't. No, I mean, you know, we all have things that we can't get in.
So Zoe well. Leonard.
Sorry?
No, but were there other things that you would like to investigate in the future that
Yeah, I mean,
them?
Investigation is our, you know, last yeah. name, right? So we continue to do that. And I don't really want to answer that.
Yeah.
Because I haven't really worked on that, you yeah. know. So, yes, there are many other people who were even considered within the process, within the show, more contemporary, you know, artists. And in the end, it seemed sufficient yeah. what it was for the purpose that yeah. I had with this exhibition in mind. So, you know, we can talk about it, but, like, off the camera.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's more than sufficient. I guess one question I would have is, in terms of what's happened to photography in the last 15 years with its mm-hmm. digitalization, mm-hmm. the increasing obsolescence mm. of physical yeah. prints, how yeah. photographs circulate on Facebook pages right. and camera phones, right. etc., whether those conditions of taking and distributing photographs right. open up new intersections of photography and sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something I have an answer for, but, mm-hmm. You know, the current ways in which we encounter photographs tend not to be paper-based things anymore. Mm-hmm. So I wonder how that changed materiality.
Mm-hmm.
Impacts on this.
Yeah. You know, it's not such a new thing.
Maybe. Yeah.
I mean, really, if I think about it, there are things. These discussions, you know, think of McLuhan, you know, and the global village. This is like something that came almost 20 years ago, and. And the whole idea that now we are not within the sort of Newtonian type of world, but rather that things happen within Eisensteinian, you know, law and the speed of light kind mm. of things. But I don't know what kind of form, you know, digital right now, it's still a material, although it is also virtual. And in terms of the circulation of things, this again, it's like not so new. It has happened since the 20s onwards, this sort of explosion. Collage is the reason why we have collage is because of the explosion of such imagery and the circulation of images. But anyway, it's unfair because I haven't really thought about it, and
yeah.
Maybe you have something to add to this, since it's just because it.
I think the answer is in the Daguerre soup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In that section, I'm not only half joking. It was my favorite section, but not only are there digital photographs in that section, Rachel's a digital wreck.
Oh yeah, I have something else.
Yeah, but archival forms, sculptures that are claimed as sculpture that actually only exist as images. I mean, those conditions only are exacerbated.
Right.
With the conditions that Mark is just pointing to have been the reigning ones for photography in the last decade plus.
And then just to add to some things that Mark and Roxana were just playing with, because I think it's an entirely different show.
Yeah.
And I also appreciate the question about why things aren't in this show, like it's so inclusive, which is what I understood. But to get back to this digital issue, I've been thinking a lot that there are no longer photographs, there are only files. And that the way artists are thinking right now about making pictures, it's really just, maybe it's been going on for so long or not for so long. I mean, time is not really relevant to this because the speed with which I see a transformation, the kind of art that's being made, and then also with younger artists in terms of their images, so the way they look at their images. So then to go back to Sarah's questions about whether or not I had concerns about the material or if this work was about the material, I was suddenly thinking, oh, it absolutely is, because I didn't print them in a darkroom. I bought an Epson archival inkjet printer, and I looked at them, and I thought, God, I wouldn't decide to make this look this way. So maybe the material presence of my pictures is that I thought they were kind of uber digital, like the colors, like, wow, I didn't choose this, right? And then I didn't do any post-production, nothing on the computer, no altering of the file, and that I didn't have files. So that I had only these files that I wouldn't alter. So there is a material honesty to it in that way. And then in terms of the circulation of the file, which Mark is directing us towards, and the way that images now can then be used photographically, just printed on a call it a painting. If it's on canvas, it's a painting, right? It's the same file that could have been on paper, right?
Scary.
Thank you. So I'm quite interested in looking at the exhibition from the point of view of looking at the photographs of sculpture that are from a time whenever sculpture and photography had a lot more in common in terms of like the physical process and the apparatus involved and the time spent, and then looking at the photographs of sculptures that are like your work that's very immediate and completely different in terms of the time spent taking the photograph and producing that. Contrasting to how the sculpture's been made. But I was really interested as well in just asking about the Voyage of the Beagle and thinking about the way that you've made this work and thinking about the actual Voyage of the Beagle and the endeavour involved in everything and having new photography, which would have been so helpful in every way, and whether you were consciously kind of choosing not to really put the same kind of endeavor of discovering anything to kind of make the discoveries and to document them in such a quick and easy way as a kind of comment on and contrast to the whole kind of endeavor of the original voyage and that time period and the things you couldn't do. And yeah.
Oh, you mean that it is the choice of title, right? Because the work existed prior to the title. The title always comes later. One thing I thought about was that what Darwin's notes from being on this boat is, it's the observation then leads to theory. So all you can really do is look and observe and experience the world, and then later you might have ideas about it. So that when he was on the Beagle, he was making drawings, he was taking notes, and you're right to point out he couldn't photograph it, and of course that was something I was thinking about, but it didn't really become a very important thing for me. I didn't feel like, I'm not making any comments on Darwin, I'm not thinking about it in that way. And that ultimately what I spent a year doing was ordering the photographs. It might have been easy to take them, but ordering them and making them whole was the whole, that's the work.
Yeah, the work, but I think the ordering and the kind of classification that you're doing is really interesting in relation to
his classification.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's why the title came easily.
Yeah.
It sort of it was a good marriage.
We are over time, and I'm sure there are other questions, but I would like to thank Rachel and George and Sarah and Mark for their very insightful presentations, and all of you for staying with us this evening and contributing your questions. And I would like to conclude just by inviting you an open invitation on Tuesday, October 26th at the School of Visual Arts at 7 p.m. We will have another panel discussion with artist Eleanor Antin and Robin Rhode, and I look forward to seeing you all then. Thank you and good night.
Thank you.